and Guildenstern are dead.
The pronouncement sounded so much like one the ambassador to England uttered in the closing scene of Hamlet that I right away had to consult my Shakespeare mortality chart, an indispensable visual aid for keeping track of which characters have exited the bard's stage for good.
Three witch characters.
Three witch characters. Witch, two witches, and one troll.
That's right.
In the Hamlet example, Rosenthal and Guildenstern are two-thirds of a barbershop quartet who were pecked to death by animatronic hen's teeth as they sang a bawdy version of O Rosabella.
O Rosabella.
In this case, they are two composers from a small atonal outpost to the left of and slightly above the Algonquin Free Desert in the Massachusetts outback. Guildenstern, by the way, has never actually been seen and is reputed to be a figment of Rosencrantz's imagination.
Rosencrantz?
Rosenthal.
Who's Rosencrantz?
Some answers are best left unquestioned. This is one of them.
And you say they're dead.
No, you said they were dead. I accepted your statement at face value. However, after conducting a thorough investigation into the matter, I concur that they are indeed dead.
How dead? As dead as a doornail?
No, not that dead.
So they aren't all the way dead.
That is correct, for there are several levels of dead. Conventional wisdom places Rosenthal and Guildenstern at level 4, which is as dead as an upholstered organ grinder in aspic, roughly speaking.
Yum. Well, if they're not all the way dead, can one deduce that they are, in fact, alive?
Yes.
They're alive.
To a point.
Oh.
Their deaths are existential and can be exemplified by the mathematical formula A plus B, parentheses, minus C equals D, where A is Rosenthal, B is imaginary Guildenstern, C is $46, and D is dead.
Why $46?
That's the existential part of the equation. It could just as easily be a wedge of Rangoon Stammel pie that has not been refrigerated for more than a week.
You've talked about a lot of food so far. I like the aspic part.
In either case, it is a mechanism that leads to Rosenthal's death.
Even though he's not all the way dead.
Quite right.
And Guildenstern
is not only not all the way dead, but is also not all the way real.
Much as the aforementioned $46 is not real.
You catch on quickly.
But is there an underlying point to all of this? This imaginary Guildenstern and the not all the way dead Rosenthal?
Remember, you're the one who first announced their deaths.
Oh, yeah.
Was there a point to that? Or do you simply go around declaring the odd decedent when it strikes your fancy?
I was merely articulating a meta-theatrical plot device that is crucial to this discourse.
This course?
Of course.
Who did you say were dead again?
I didn't say they were dead again. I said only that they were dead this one time. To be dead again implies a previous death followed, one presumes, by a rather extraordinary recovery, and according to recent revealed information from you, if I'm not mistaken, they aren't even dead, at least not all the way.
Oh, very well. However, I do believe we've strayed from the initial conversational thread.
Not at all. I clearly remember saying Rosenthal and Guildenstern are dead.
So you did. And I rejoined by consulting my Shakespeare mortality chart. It's all coming back to me now. And from there, we orally duped it out by employing existential, things.
Things, yes. We engaged in inductive logic by using arguments in which the premises supported the conclusion but did not entail it.
There was, of course, that argument we mutually deemed invalid because it lacked a premise that would make it valid.
We were but quibbling over disguised assumptions.
That were inherently capable of being neither true nor false.
Except rhetorically!
So, we have a premise.
Well, Rosenthal and Guildenstern are dead!
Followed by a proposition.
Proposition that they're not actually dead.
That leads to a logical conclusion.
$46 wasn't enough to finish them off!
QED.
Did you say KND?
No, but it's on my agenda to do so as soon as we've exhausted all of the modalities of this argument.
If the modalities aren't exhausted, it's likely that our audience are, or will soon be.
QED.
No, KND.
Who, one hopes, are not as dead as Rosenthal and Guildenstern.
Rest assured that they are neither dead nor are they in arrears to the tune of $46.
We cannot but rest, assuredly or otherwise, for we have a house to put in order.
I trust you have formulated premises that lead to that conclusion.
Indeed. Premise number one. A composer calling himself Rosenthal is at the door.
Along with the imaginary Guildenstern?
Yes. or no. No. It doesn't matter. It isn't part of the syllogism.
Then what else is?
Premise number two.
Number two!
The door serves at the entrance to the house in which Calvos and Damien...
K.N.D.
Are
what?
Are about to invite the composer Rosenthal to join them...
In the house.
Q.E.D.
No, K.
And D. From a new release from Art Jarvinen, 100 Cadences with 4 Melodies, a Chorale, and a Coda with Bells on. That was the 8th section, Cadences 79 to 100. Art was recently a guest, and we just love him. And so, you were having
a... I had a...
Yes, oh, Bruce. Please.
No,
what?
Oh, what? Very much alive.
No, no.
Oh, he is very much alive.
So it would seem.
He's here.
Who?
In the house.
In the house.
Oh, in the house.
With us.
Yes. Singing about to sing Rosa Bella.
Oh, Rosa.
Diana.
Bella.
I don't remember the rest of the words.
I don't know.
There aren't any other words.
Oh, yeah. No, it's 13-something or other. Okay. Our guest is, in fact, here. In the house.
The house. And it is a house.
It is. We are, yes, we are in beautiful downtown Hanover, New Hampshire. Hanover, New Hampshire.
On the road.
On the road. Off the road.
Yes.
The Tom didn't get us quite here. Kept wanting to take us to the other side of the house where you can't get in.
Thank goodness we didn't follow it all the way, but was
we
quite
were driven through the front wall.
We can do that on the way back.
Oh yes, a good idea.
But first, we have a chat to get
out
of the way.
Yes, out of the way. Dean Rosenthal is our guest here on K&D. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing good. You're petting a dog.
Yep. This is a dog named Lily. Lily is Larry Polanski's dog.
Larry is Larry.
There's a transgender problem here.
Sure. Okay, could be. It's a very pleasant dog. I don't know the provenance of the dog necessarily, but
dogness.
The dogness of prominence.
And from there we can jump straight away into some musical.
Yes. The question is, what instrument did you learn first?
I started out with maybe a Fisher-Price drum kit at age 3, but in reality, I picked up the guitar around age 10, like pretty much every other 10-year-old out there, which is pretty, but the Fisher-Price thing sticks in the mind, especially.
And that's what brought you to composition?
Well, probably, just banging around a little bit at home. What's this beat here? What's that there? You know, it sounds kind of cool together.
Which would account for the underlying rhythmic motifs in almost every one of your compositions.
My rhythm is the worst.
We'll get to that.
But at any rate, we're
going to play some pieces, and we will have some discussion about rhythm and also some pitch choices. But first of all, tell us about you. Give us a little background on who you are, your career path, if it is a real career path or just a composer's path, which generally doesn't involve ever having a career. But start us out from Fisher-Price onward.
And don't leave out the part about your relationship with the transgender dog.
Right. Well, somewhere in Concord, once upon a...
the great capital of the world.
Concord, Massachusetts, cradle of the American Revolution. So I was born there in 1974, and then fast forward to the Fisher-Price drum set around age 3, I guess, and... Then there was a Kiss guitar, straight from Toys R Us.
Oh,
just
wow.
Kiss, the rock band, out of the 70s.
Oh, sure.
Sure. Those guys, really.
Out of the 70s.
Out of the 70s.
We were hardly born then.
Really.
Well, hard to think back that long ago.
I don't know. And I was thrilled. So fast forward 7 years later, I was 10, and getting into skateboards and girls and music, and well, I was listening to a lot of Van Halen and Cyndi Lauper. I have no idea what.
That's right.
It's absolutely. So anyway, there's some private details that are revealed, and I picked up the guitar because I thought, wow, this is a really neat instrument, and. Turned out that I don't know, that seemed to happen pretty well. It took a couple years of lessons and I don't know, tried to gain, you know, there was some competence going on there, but I seem to have had this particular urge to just make sounds and organizing different kinds of sounds. So I took a lot of lawn mowing and paper route money, which is sort of like another little story
that,
in itself.
For soon-to-be present generations, that paper routes were when newspapers, which is a print medium, were actually delivered to individual homes.
No.
Yes, sometimes on a daily basis.
No.
Hard to believe, but it really did happen.
Yeah.
And they paid people to do this.
And that's the same thing about lawn mowing. People would deliver lawnmowers.
Yes, they would deliver lawnmowers every day. Yes.
Down
so you took your money from
right. That's from right, and I threw it down the drain and bought a little four-track recorder and some guitar effects pedals, and I started putting tunes together. And they weren't songs. They weren't rock songs or whatever. They were just sort of I don't know, little collages of various noises and melodies. And
we must hear one.
Nope. There's none.
Nothing extant
to be heard.
Anyway. So, I don't know. I thought it would be cool to write down music at one point, so I just sort of drawing it on staff paper, and later on someone said, you know, you should probably learn, you know, what those circles and, you know, little staffs mean. So a couple teachers taught me that, and then I ended up, jumping off to a college. I went to McGill University in Montreal. And
don't just slide by that. Let's hear more about this McGill experience, because they have a bit of a reputation in their music department and you know, various things like that. Do tell. What was McGill like, in what year would that have been?
It was, well, do I have to tell you what year?
Well, just approximately, what decade?
Okay. All right. Well, it was in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was in the early 90s. And
we could extrapolate.
Hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of very cool students there at the time.
McGillicuddies, I think they were called.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, anyway, so we were there, and it was kind of a conservative type of atmosphere. Learned a pretty strict European model on some level, where they had the ear training and the history, and the theory is one particular track. And so I went through that. A lot of just, I don't know, really interesting. Susan McClary, really amazing musicologist, was there at the time, and some incredible professors that I studied under. Schubert and Charles Taylor.
What was the stuff that you studied that?
Well,
something must have kept you going as a sort of a nascent composer.
As a nascent composer. Mm. At the time, I was just trying to make sense of how music was put together, but at one point, again, with this idea, okay, I've really got to write something. And a friend of mine had started to listen to more of the, I don't know, I guess what we now know, American contemporary and experimental.
The Van Halen school.
Right. Well, moving on from that, you know, listening to, I guess, a little more of the Charles Ives and Steve Reich and whomever was out there.
Now there's the panoply, from Charles Ives to Steve Reich.
Okay. Yeah, well, there's Big Skip. You know, maybe we went through John Cage and Henry Cowell and Harry Parch and everyone else. You know, I found I would go through the libraries after class because none of this music was being taught there, which was a real drag. This was straight just European music. And then you got to the 20th century stuff, and it kind of stopped at Darmstadt for some reason. Anyway, I would go to
You know, Darmstadt is still going.
Yeah, well, at any rate, I've been recommended, you know. Okay, well, why don't you try that out? I don't think so. But great times in the music library, just trying to listen to, just listening to as much good music as I could. And at that point, I think I just started to I don't know, intuit a lot of the music that I had been listening to, and I decided that I wanted to write more, both in an experimental vein, but also, I don't know, just trying to actually write something that made sense to others on a more serious level. So I ended up writing a little string quartet, which is, you know, it's kind of a cliche, and I wrote it in D minor, which was the ultimate cliche.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But and it turned out, I still have it, and it turned out to be a real student piece, maybe, but it led to some other stuff that was just there were sound collages at the time. There was a piece named Ear Trainer that I wrote in 1996.
Yeah, we're going to ask you about that. As a matter of fact, we might as well play that one now, because we had a question: is what were you training? Were you training people to find what you collaged and figure out what it was you used in it? What
the
were you training?
Idea
exactly?
Was a real earbender. I think I had listened to too much Charles Ives at that point, you know, and I was just thinking to myself, you know, everyone at this school is just. Not well. Anyway, there were a lot of judgments going on, but at any rate, I thought, well, let's bend some ears. Let's try to combine a bunch of samples and sounds. And I went around, and you know, I had this little handheld tape recorder, so I taped just whatever I could find: toilets flushing, clapping at the end of lectures. And
see,
then
so it wasn't pieces that we were supposed to recognize.
I see.
They always sound so much like pieces you're supposed to recognize, but they're just not quite right.
So this was at McGill.
Yeah, it was at the last year. But I wasn't writing these for classes or anything like that. I wasn't studying composition, so that was a mess in itself. But at any rate,
well,
yeah.
Let's hear it. For somebody who
yep.
was just, you know, sort of messing around, this is a long piece. It's about 11 minutes, and it's really got layers, and it's got a lot. Did you do any modification, or is it purely a collage?
No, I wrote it on a four-track. What do you mean by modification?
Well, in other words, you didn't do any... well, since you did it on 4-track, you didn't do any computer modification to it.
I don't even think they had computers back then.
Wrong.
This young fella, he doesn't understand. He doesn't remember. Let's listen to Ear Trainer is here by our guest today on Calvo's Damien.
In the house.
Dean Rosenthal.
Thank you. Before I begin, yes.
The challenges.
interesting and rich things to explore, at the end of the 20th century.
We're back. That was Ear Trainer. It's a collection of found sounds, you might say, things that you thought were interesting and mixed into a piece. Ear Trainer Dean Rosenthal is our guest. Well, that was the long piece. And then what was happening from there? Did you go through some sort of transformation? Because at some point we're going to get to these portraits. Or
yeah, I put on a cape and I flew to Los Angeles.
Ah.
And I don't know, I had applied to these graduate schools at the time, and some of them were kind of hoity-toity. And I thought, okay, well, I can become a professor and pursue a doctoral career. Or
we all love
that. Yeah, I know, that would have been good. Because I would be living in a shotgun shack, I guess. But at any rate, so I ended up going to a Californian school named CalArts, which was a lot of fun, very experimental, and just a real, lots of... So I had written that piece and a couple others, and I don't know, I was still very much like I think I am now in a learning mode, so I tried to get...
So you got to CalArts, and there you worked with... Who were the people you worked with there? I know that you did interview David Rosenboom.
I had studies with... I found Morton Subotnick in in a hall at one point, and I was really convinced at that time, okay, I need to study with this guy. He is just, a living legend. Even though I was interested in instrumental music, so I bargained him into giving me lessons because he had a full schedule. So I studied with...
What do you offer Morton to get him to give you lessons?
Right. Well, in this case, it took... how did I do it?
Don't have to admit this. I mean,
dips on his Kiss guitar.
Ah,
you would
or the Fisher Price drum set. Morton's probably would like that.
Please take me as a student. I didn't come here to study with. I don't know. So we went there, and I ended up taking courses with David Rosenboom and Michael John Fink, and just all sorts of Mel Powell was there at the time, and really great composers came that year: Robert Ashley, David Behrman, Chen Yi. It was Alvin Lucier. It was wild for me. Joan LaBarbera, William Winnett. So these were all just heroes of mine at the time, and still are. And at any rate, I started writing some more electronic stuff under Morton Subotnick at that time. And but those were the teachers that I had at CalArts.
And did, when you sort of studied with them or alongside them, did you see a transformation happening in yourself, or was it a reinforcement of what you'd already started with?
Kind of a little both.
That won't do. That's too wishy-washy.
Yeah,
something
we want.
All right. I would have to say yes. There was a transformation going on. One day, I walked into Morton Subotnick's office or whatever it was, which is just this. I don't even know where he was. He heard a piece that I had written. He said, make something up. And I came back with a piece that was sort of an homage to John Cage. It was written in the space of, it's about a 46-second piece, I think, that took snippets of different recordings that I had found. And Frances Marie Weedy playing, I don't know, they're all just...
Frances Marie was
yeah, she was. Well, I was recording. It was on a tomato recording.
You really did have a great collection there.
Yeah. Well, I stole a lot of music from other people. So, and I found these cassettes in the CalArts library. John Cage speaking, just giving, I don't know, different lectures, making all kinds of. And he just had the weirdest sound.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was not electronically enhanced. That was done live.
So there he, anyway, so I thought, well, let's incorporate that. And there were some other stuff that I threw in there. Anyway, Mort liked it. He said, write, seven or eight more of these, and, we can, call it a day. And then you can start, on something new.
So these are the portraits or the small pieces that you've done?
Yeah.
This is the interesting collection. Some were clear, but in their titles, others were not. Like Kansas Has This About It.
Yeah, Kansas is actually the Cage piece, where I was going through one of his books, Silence, which is the most famous and the most obvious, and there's a lecture in there, or writing, named Lecture on Nothing, with all of your listeners are probably...
Not our listener.
No doubt, completely familiar. The singular. Right, listener. The one listener that's out there listening to this show. That had a particular line in the lecture. Kansas has this about it. So I thought, well, yeah, it does. It does, John. So I will take that and...
So give us a little run through of each one. They're very short, so make it a short run through.
Right.
Not
right.
Longer than the piece. Right, Buddhist right. Spouting sound vessel.
Well,
you can hear that test.
Yeah, yeah, that was about, I made that one up, but that was about the baritone new music promoter guru, Tom Buckner, and he...
Tom Buckner Baritone.
Yeah, well, yeah,
this is his full name.
That's his full
name. Right, okay, Tom Buckner Baritone. And he ended up, you know, he showed up there too that year. And so I thought, okay, well, this guy, he's really unusual. Why don't I tape him saying, you know, whatever comes
to
mind.
Damien was absolutely right. You said that sounds like Tom Buckner.
Baritone.
Yes, baritone.
Yeah.
His voice is rather
absolutely yes.
Yeah. All right. So that was him, and you know, I just put, I don't know. Again, I took a lot of other recordings and I sort of mashed them up long before.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, for me, it's important to put forward that this was years before Garage Band or anything like that. And these, again, they were just written on four tracks, which is good.
Months,
you know.
Anyway.
I think that months. At least they were. You know, so it was all analog technology, and for me,
what
I don't
that
know.
Term?
That's what I was writing on.
Anna King of Simanalog.
Yeah, that's it. That's
right, but you said to keep this brief. I've gone for a little.
Right.
So there are other ones.
It
that
would enter invisibly. We're gonna listen to this whole set.
That's an homage to Lou Harrison. Mm-hmm. It's another composer at the time,
sure.
Very and still. So it's just a collection of snippets.
And then you have Cardew 5969, which
Cardew's is a little bit different. I was very enamored of Cornelius Cardew, my undergraduate, and I directed a concert of his great, his masterpiece there, The Great Learning. So I took part of those recordings and I mixed them up with some other, I don't know, just... other things I had found.
We'd love to have Cardew on the show, but he's been dead for a while,
yeah,
so we can't do
that. Hasn't stopped us in the past.
We could make it up.
Yeah.
He was, you know, so I worked that in somehow.
And for Morton Feldman. Sounds like a dedication.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, that piece went through a number of name changes, but, you know, I finally realized, well, he names his pieces, you know, for Benita Marcos or something like that, so I should do that too. I found tapes in the, again, you know, just different recordings of him speaking, and I thought, and I had this other great CD of him playing his own music, and I took that, and I you know, grabbed a couple quotes of it. I would write all these out in graph paper and just organize, take everything very seriously and very specifically, quoting excerpts and rearranging them structurally. And that's not just for this piece, but for every piece of this series.
And Sinfonia.
It's a mashup, kind of mixes Sinfonia, that third movement of Berio's famous piece, and Kathy Berberian singing the folk songs, Black is the color of my true love's hair, and some other tunes of hers. So I thought, well, I would mix that up. You know, he was married to her at least once or twice, and you know, put that together.
And how about Gouldberg variation? Who's Gould here?
Gould.
Morton Gould.
Morton Gould.
Yes.
That would be.
Gould.
The Gould and this.
You're playing
contract.
That damn piece too, right? Sorry, Aaron.
Now it's
yeah.
In my head.
Oh, it's gonna never go away.
The Gould in this context was the Canadian pianist Glenn Gould.
Oh, Glenn Gould.
Yeah. Unfortunately for me, he wasn't around to, you know, to tape or to make fun of or you know, for him to make fun of me. And so, you know, I grabbed a couple of recordings that, there was a very famous recording of his, sort of the Goldberg Variations, and still is famous, and I think it was the first one he made too. Anyway, put those together.
And this eighth one clearly has the voice of Henry Cavill.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones. I named that Antinomy, which was, I think that was just something that he was spouting off at the end of one of his recordings for Smithsonian Folkways. And so, you know, there were a couple great pieces of his that I particularly enjoyed. I threw those together, and out came Antinomy.
And here's one that looks like satiated that says, that's actually satiated.
Yeah, there's another influence there of Eric Satie somehow. So,
who was at the school as well while you were there?
Yeah, he kind of showed up there.
In a box.
You know, came out as a sort of the word escapes me right now, but it anyway. So he was there.
Let's hear them. Right. These are these nine short pieces. Our guest is Dean Rosenthal. Here they are. Kansas has this about it, the Buddhist spouting sound vessel. It would enter invisibly, Cardew 5969, for Morton Feldman, Sinfonieren, Goldberg Variation, Antinomy, Henry Cowell, and Satiated.
Or you may leave it forever and never return to it. For we possess nothing. For we possess nothing.
Listening.
We are on the train.
Listening.
We are on the train.
Listening.
We are on the train.
Listening.
Buddhist spouting sound vessel.
Sign of the time.
Buddhist spouting sound vessel. Buddhist spouting. Buddhist spouting sound vessel.
Sadness.
Listening.
What's going on is music.
It would enter sort of invisibly and disappear in throbs.
Thank you. Years back, someone said to me, if you love something, why change it?
It is an experiment. Antinomy. People very often ask me, what's that? To which I, of course, replied, what's this? Thank you.
Those were 9 shard pieces.
What were?
Pieces we just heard. You stopped listening?
Sorry.
Number did you stop listening at?
-0.
-0.
Yes.
Our guest is Dean Rosenthal here on KND.
In the house.
And we listened to the short pieces. Let's move on to where you went from there. What happened in your life? I mean, what changed that you... Because we have some acoustic pieces coming up, too.
Sure. That was the instrumental stuff. Well, I had moved to Boston, but I left CalArts. I dropped out after the first year for a number of reasons. But for the most part... I don't know. I guess it was a health issue there. I was diagnosed
from you or from the school.
Yeah, well, they were both. It was from me. It was my particular health issue. I started to get into a psychological psychiatric space. It was later diagnosed as bipolar disorder, which to me, in my eyes, kept me from really fulfilling that particular degree in that direction at the time. So I ended up moving to Boston, and I put on a couple of concerts here or there, and I wrote some pieces.
A couple of concerts of your own stuff?
Of my own stuff, other local composers who were around.
Just like storefront concerts or school concerts?
Right.
Tell me a little bit about this.
There was a great gallery in Somerville, Massachusetts in the late 90s and early aughties named the Gallery Breshad. And that gallery had artists, composers, bands, musicians, just creators, poets of all types and kinds. And the guy, Breshad, he ended up, he was an architect, but he had decided to put this together. And keep in mind, this was really like a small kind of square out north of Cambridge. And Boston at the time, it's kind of a small city in many ways. So,
part of that is euphemistic?
Right. Well, I'm not sure I get that. But at any rate, he had some concerts there, and I put one of those together. I guess they were just mostly of my own works. I took to promoting them a little bit, and I was writing some music at the time. I'm realizing right now that the chronology might be a little off. I had written one of these pieces that we might hear before I had gone to CalArts, so now it comes to me. But at any rate, that's where I went. That's where I was at the time. I had moved to Boston. That's where I had started to write some instrumental music.
Were you affiliated at all with either BMOP or the Red Sneaker crowd?
No, I wish. That would have been great. But no, not at all. But they were there. There was a lot of incredible, just creative stuff going on. I think in terms of BMOP or the Red Sneaker group, I know Susan Allen, who had been out at CalArts.
A former guest on Calvus and Dave.
Right, former guest there. Well, anyway... She was a founding member of that, and so we talked about that a lot. But I had no relationship to that, in one way or another. Although I showed up at their concerts and supported them vociferously.
Showed up with scores, saying, "Here's mine, here's mine."
Exactly. I don't know.
So how did? Well, Boston was sort of a strange place to be going to from California. Did it sort of feel smaller in some way? I mean,
I think
it's a small city, but
well,
did, you know...
I'll tell you, I'm
thinking
from
the triangulation, starting at McGill, then to California, then to Boston. So next, I think, probably the Northwest Territories.
Oh, I was thinking the other way. Maybe Big Bend National Park.
Oh, that would work, yeah.
Right.
Good acoustics there, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it wasn't such a strange shift for me because I grew up, or in general, as you're like, it has that, is that I grew up in Western Massachusetts, which really wasn't so far away from Boston.
But culturally it's far.
Maybe, but Boston is kind of the default city for Massachusetts or something like that. So it was a little further away, and I hadn't really gone into a city until I had moved to Montreal as a student. But it was a shift of some sort. But I mean, I couldn't stay on the West Coast personally. I wanted to be in a place where there were corner store, just you could walk down the street and you would see a block of apartments and that kind of thing. But anyway, in terms of a music scene, it was very different from Los Angeles at the time. So
let's hear a little. We've heard the Ear Trainer, which is electroacoustic. Let's hear a couple of other pieces. We have this piece Ariel. Tell me a little bit about that. It'd be nice to play that one now. Good.
That piece was written in Boston, dedicated to a professor of mine at McGill, and I think it was whipped up during a day or two. And there were kind of a little bit of sort of sketchy circumstances around it, but at any rate, it came out pretty quickly. And I was living in an apartment on a street named Royce Road, near the intersection of Commonwealth Avenue and Harvard Street in Alston. And I was a real mess at the time. I had this apartment was, I didn't, you know, for whatever reason, it's just I hadn't been taking care of myself. I had an apartment with no furniture in it, and I was sleeping on the floor on a rug that was pretty much my sole possession at that point.
He was studying minimalism.
Now. Yes. and there were just boxes of stuff that I had, you know, accumulated over the years, but they were all unpacked. And at some point I thought, well, I need to get in touch with somebody. And so I wrote to this professor of mine, and we started talking about choral music and that bit, and then all of a sudden it became clear to me that I had to set Sylvia Plath's poem Ariel, and in the end that's what happened next.
So Sylvia Plath is seems to be the choice of people going through dramatic transformations.
Right, the bell jar,
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, is it? Is that the case?
It seems that whenever you see a setting of Plath, it's somebody who's been recently through a wrenching experience or about to embark on one, but not somebody who's just sort of a steady career composer. You don't see those steady career composers doing Plath.
Yeah, I wouldn't begin to know what that would mean, but... I suppose there was some relationship there to her. I had lived in Prague in the Czech Republic for about 6 months previous to moving to Boston.
Oh, you skipped that part.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Because not much happened there. It was just living over there. I don't know. I'd gone over there to see a friend and stayed. Didn't, you know, have so much else to do. Hey, let's check this city out.
So what year would that have been?
Around. It would have been 1999, and I got into reading Sylvia Plath at the time. So
I was there in 1999.
Oh yeah,
I just didn't cross.
Oh
down.
Cool.
So was Sylvia, wasn't she? In a box.
No, somehow, I don't think her box made it that far.
in terms of her particular. You know, mindset that she might engender. I don't know. It was inspiring to me at the time. I mean, I think it's a phase that a lot of, you know, maybe college students go through. You read Sylvia Plath and you get kind of bummed out, and you know, but
yeah,
then
just like college.
Yeah, I guess so. But I don't know. I mean, for me, they're just really moving works
of
art, her poetry, and I stand behind it. I think it's great.
Let's hear it. This is Ariel. Our guest today is Dean Rosenthal.